This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 23 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. June can be a tough month for sports fans, especially in recent years if you're a sports fan of a team that's not from the Bay Area, Cleveland, or Pittsburgh. I don't know if you've heard, but the Penguins won back-to-back Stanley Cups. But June kind of sucks. From a football perspective, it's a month of waiting. The good stuff hasn't really started yet, and the only news that we get from team camps is good news. Nothing bad or negative happens in June. We never hear stories about players not performing well. We did, though, get some fantasy-relevant news this week as Jeremy Maclin signed with the Ravens. And that's where we'll start with this week's mailbag. So the first question is from Britt Devine of RotoGrinders, at Britt_Devine. And he simply said, I bet people want to know about Maclin. And he's right. I think people want some Maclin takes. Generally speaking, when a wide receiver joins a team, it's not good news for the wide receivers who were already on that team. Volume is king in fantasy football, first and foremost, and with additional bodies comes an additional split in market share. Pre-Maclin signing, Mike Wallace was looking hot this year. He was a fantasy darling in the industry. He was bound to see more than a 20% market share in that offense given the departure of Steve Smith and the fact that no one else was really there to take away targets. Mike Wallace was looking good. Post-Maclin signing, I've got Mike Wallace at a 17% market share in the offense for about 107 targets. That's certainly still okay, but it's not what we were expecting in May from Mike Wallace. Breshad Perriman was bumped down to about 91 targets, and Maclin himself, I've got at 116 targets. These are a little different than what I had tweeted earlier in the week because I also changed my pessimistic outlook on the Ravens' pass attempts, upping their total by about 17 after making some adjustments. Make no mistake, though, I don't think the Ravens are going to be nearly as pass-heavy as they've been the last 2 years. 2 years where they've led the entire NFL in pass attempts. The Greg Roman hire is one of those reasons, without a doubt, but I talked about this on a previous mailbag episode if you guys are interested. Maclin's probably going to play a lot of slot in the Ravens' offense. That's my guess. Last season, among all 50-plus target wideouts, Maclin was in the top third percentile in percentage of slot routes run. As he ages, it only makes sense to keep him there, especially in this particular Ravens offense. As for my model, he's listed at wide receiver 35, but I also don't think he provides teams with a ton of upside. And remember, when I say wide receiver 35, he's also only like 10 points away from being wide receiver 45, because that's generally how projections work out. There's not a significant difference between him and a lower-end wide receiver 3. Mike Wallace, for reference, is more in the Quincy Enunwa range for me now, and Perriman is strictly a later-round upside pick, depending on what happens in camp and in the preseason. So overall, he's fine. I think he'll be usable given he should see the field a lot, given that versatility, but I don't think that I want to scream the word upside when talking about a Ravens wide receiver. Basically, I don't expect a Steve Smith from a few years ago type of season because I don't think the market share in this offense is going to get that high for any of these wide receivers. This next one's from at Heath K. He says, when projecting players, how do you negotiate between positional average rates and player average rates? I love this question from Heath because it's a struggle anyone making projections has to go through. The fact of the matter is, projections have subjectivity littered throughout them. Market share numbers, for instance, are educated guesses based on history and a player's potential in an offense. So you certainly need to understand player roles to accurately project market share numbers. But since volume dictates so much in fantasy football, getting the market share numbers right, as well as how pass-friendly a team is going to be so you can get the volume in the first place, is of the utmost importance. That's why on this show, I will always stress volume projections, as I did with the Ravens example I just walked through. But with efficiency, and to answer this question, the way I work it is by player sample first. That's especially true if that player has been in the league for a while and we kind of know what to expect out of him. And then for rookies or guys who haven't been in the league very long, I have to factor in a lot more. What have historical rates looked like for first-year guys? What kind of jump do players usually see from year one to year two? Has a particular player seen his efficiency rise each year in the league? I have a formula that will do most of the work for me with this, but then I go through each guy and adjust accordingly. And I adjust based on important nuggets of info I read and see and so on. So to answer the question super directly, I look at player career first and then look at positional averages. And for the record, I do what Mike Clay noted in the projections episode, and that's to project pretty conservative efficiency numbers for rookies because it's very easy to fall into a trap of over-projecting first-year guys. This next one's from Twitter, at K0Shaughnessy, says, Ryan with an outlier season is due negative touchdown slash overall regression, but Julio is due positive touchdown regression. Julio a good bet? So here's the thing with Julio Jones. He's almost always due for positive regression. I like to use NumberFire's reception net expected points metric to regress touchdown numbers because, as I talked with Keith Goldner on the Net Expected Points podcast that we did last month, NEP shows us how many real points a player is contributing for his team over expectation. Reception NEP looks at points added on catches only, so it's a nice cumulative stat to work off of. According to NEP, Julio has scored more touchdowns than his net expected points total suggested he should have scored just twice in his six-year career, and both of those seasons came during his first two campaigns in the NFL. Last season, Julio's six touchdowns should have been between 8 and 9, according to net expected points. It was 8.62. 2 years ago, his eight touchdowns should have been closer to 11. 3 years ago, his six scores should have been between 10 and 11. I mean, this is what Julio Jones kind of is at this point. He's not scoring a ton of touchdowns because the Falcons, for whatever reason, aren't utilizing him that much in the red zone. In 2014, Roddy White had 14 red zone targets, 10 targets from within the 10, and all of those actually came from within the 5. That same year, Julio had 12 red zone targets, so two fewer, and he had 5 targets from within the 10 and just 2 from within the 5. Then in 2015, when Roddy White was basically a corpse on a football field, Julio Jones saw 203 targets. He had 22 red zone targets, 12 from within the 10, and 5 from within the 5. For some context, though, despite seeing 203 targets, he was 6th in the NFL in red zone targets that year, a wide receiver. He tied for 5th in targets from within the 10, and 8 dudes had more targets from within the 5. Considering he had 203 targets, that's not great. And then last year, with more competition in Atlanta for volume, Jones tied Justin Hardy in red zone targets with 10. Mohamed Sanu had more. Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman had more. They had way more. I mean, at some point, you have to think that this is just kind of a thing. And with so many weapons in Atlanta, and looking at what they did just this last year, you can't, like, totally fault what they're doing with Julio Jones. They were a prolific, historic offense last year. But because of those reasons, I just can't assume that Julio Jones is a positive regression candidate in the touchdown column. He's been that before, and nothing's really happened because the Falcons' lack of Julio use close to the end zone. This next one's from Twitter, at CJB344, buying the Devontae Parker hype. I have two fears with Devontae Parker. The first is that he's in an offense that doesn't have a top-level quarterback. Over the last 5 years, so we'll get rid of Ryan Tannehill's rookie season where he threw just 12 touchdowns and the team threw 13, the Dolphins have thrown between 20 and 27 touchdowns each season. That's not a ridiculously bad floor, but that's also not a great ceiling. Now, on top of this, you've got a team that added a potential red zone weapon in Julius Thomas over the offseason, as well as a team that probably wants to run the football. Last year, when Jay Ajayi broke out, which was week 6 against Pittsburgh, the first 5 weeks of the season saw Miami with the 8th highest dropback, so that's not pass attempt, to run ratio in the league. I say dropback because that includes sacks. From week 6 through week 17, the Dolphins had a dropback to run ratio of 1.06, which was the 3rd lowest in football. Only Dallas and Buffalo, two very, very run-heavy teams. We all know those teams as being run-heavy. Those were the only two teams that were more run heavy than the Dolphins from week 6 through week 17. Of course, Ryan Tannehill didn't play all of those games, but he did average over 3 fewer pass attempts per game before getting injured last year after week 5. The offensive line also got healthy around the same time, if you recall, and they were a much better team in general running the football. So my fear is volume based, basically. I think Parker can still grab over 100 targets, but if he's going to be a breakout candidate, he's going to need to score touchdowns. With Ajayi there, Julius Thomas now there, and even Kenny Stills. Kenny Stills scored 9 touchdowns last year. And Jarvis Landry's there. I'm not sure how easy it'll be for him to see that upper end in the touchdown column to get, say, 8 touchdowns. But anything is certainly possible, as we saw from Stills last year. For those reasons, though, I'm not necessarily all in on a breakout from Parker. It certainly wouldn't shock me if he was a decent enough wide receiver too, or maybe a flex option. But he's not a guy that I'm pinpointing right now in June as the breakout wide receiver. This next one is an email from Tommy Wolf. He says, love the show. As an econ major, your emphasis on supply and demand is especially interesting. Anyways, I'm curious as to your opinion on drafting slash holding on to backup tight ends and quarterbacks in a 10-team standard roster. If you draft a tight end like Jimmy Graham or Martellus Bennett, is it worth drafting a Zach Miller in the later rounds, or is that pick better spent on a dart throw running back or wide receiver? Should you always have two quarterbacks on your roster? Thanks. 100% positively, no doubt, it's better spent on a dart throw at running back or wide receiver. You're not going to play a tight end in the flex in a standard league or in most leagues, so the demand of the position is low, as is the case at quarterback since you're starting just one. In other words, every team in your league doesn't need a lot of players at those positions. In a shallower league like a 10-team one, there should be plenty of passers and tight ends on the waiver wire as a result. Look at it this way. If you were to assume every other owner in your league rosters two quarterbacks, then you're looking at the 20th ranked quarterback sitting on the waiver wire since you'd forego drafting one yourself. The 20th quarterback going off the board according to FantasyADHD.com's MFL 10 data is Blake Bortles. Behind Blake Bortles is Carson Palmer, who was a higher-end QB1 just 2 years ago, Ryan Tannehill, who's okay, Joe Flacco, who has some upside, Sam Bradford, and Alex Smith. They don't look pretty, I get it, but those are your worst-case scenarios, and this is why it's incredibly viable to stream the quarterback position in shallower leagues. Tight end is different mostly because tight end is a disaster of a position. But if you get a Jimmy Graham, you're getting a mid-tight end one, which is better than half of your league. And as you move down the list of tight ends, the difference between a high-end tight end 2 or one that you'd have on your bench really isn't all that different. For the most part, there are some exceptions like a guy like Jack Doyle, than tight end 20 or 21 who'd be on the waiver wire. The difference between a high-end tight end 2 is not that huge versus a lower-end tight end 2. Mostly because the tight end position just sucks. Don't waste a roster spot with a backup quarterback or tight end in any sort of normal league. It's usually just not worth it. This next one's from @Diego24FPS on Twitter. As a Galladay proponent, what makes him more enticing than Chad Williams to you? Just so it's on the record, though it already is because I podcasted about it the Monday after the draft, I'm a big fan of both Galladay and Williams. But I do think in the short term, Galladay has more upside, which is why I keep tweeting about Babytron. Remember, that's his new nickname, at least to me. I'll start by saying that Galladay is the third best wide receiver in this class in my model, behind Corey Davis, obviously, and Zay Jones, actually. Subjectively, I don't like Zay Jones as much as the model does, but I'm trying to be transparent about things here. You guys want transparency, right? Galladay is the number 3 wideout, then John Ross, and then, you guessed it, Chad Williams. So I've got both dudes as top 5 wideouts in this class, or at least my model does. And that's my first go at looking at these wide receivers. And yes, they came out better than Mike Williams. Both guys have strong athletic profiles, and both players were productive in college, which is the most important thing. They both have really good market share numbers. The thing that separates them most, then, would probably be the situation. Chad Williams is in Arizona with a running back who's going to demand an unreal market share, even through the air, in the offense. Larry Fitzgerald, even at his old age, will need to see a big target share as well. They've got John Brown there still, who's more than likely going to turn things around this year now that he's got his health in check. And then there's J.J. Nelson, too. Year one, Chad Williams is going to need Larry Fitzgerald to fall off or John Brown to not rebound, and I don't think either of those things will happen. And I also think that J.J. Nelson is competition for him in terms of volume if something does happen. Meanwhile, there's not a whole lot stopping Galladay from seeing the field. If the Lions line up Golden Tate in the slot in 3 wide sets now that Anquan Boldin is gone, which sounds like it'll be the case, then Galladay is automatically going to see the field a good bit as a rookie. And Galladay is in an offense that's more than likely going to throw the ball more than Arizona's offense. I guess even from a dynasty standpoint, if we want a tiebreaker, I think you can probably look at the quarterback situation as that tiebreaker. We have no idea what Williams will be working with past a year or two, whereas people forget that Matthew Stafford is still just 22 years old. He's actually not 22, he's 29, but he's still got a lot of playing time left. So that's why I have Galladay ahead of Williams, but Williams certainly has upside. Like I said post-draft, Bruce Arians has been a monster with finding wide receiver talent, so it wouldn't surprise me at all if Williams ends up being a strong fantasy asset in the future. I basically just want both of them. This next one's from Twitter, @EricP29, PPR Keeper League, keep 2, Mike Evans, Zeke, or Ajayi. I think this one's pretty easy. You're definitely going to keep Zeke. And I think you're also definitely going to keep Mike Evans. For the record, though, I don't mind Jay Ajayi, especially if he gets more work in the passing game this year. And despite the fact that Evans' numbers dropped a bit as the Buccaneers became better defensively last year, I wrote an article on this on NumberFire, it's hard to view him as a second-round pick like Ajayi is. That, and if it's a full PPR league and you have a flex spot, wide receivers are more important than running backs. So I'll give the tiebreaker, if there was one, to Mike Evans. This next one's an email from Jeffrey Alfieri. Jeffrey sent me a pretty long email here, but I shortened it a bit for the podcast. He says, I might be a little crazy, but I'm really liking Kobe Fleener this year. I feel like he should be getting the love that Jared Cook got last season. So people love to hate Kobe Fleener. I don't think he's an especially great tight end, but I also kind of agree with you here. I think he's flying under the radar a bit. Last year, Fleener had just four top 12 tight end performances outside of week 17, which was bested by 19 tight ends. He was a low-end tight end two in fantasy football for the most part last year. All the while, he was 20th in tight end market share, meaning we'd expect that number to be a lot better considering he's playing in a Drew Brees offense with that type of market share. But things are different this year for the Saints. Brandon Cooks is gone, and Fleener is now another year into this system in New Orleans. I currently have him at a 13% target share, which is slightly better than what he had last year, and that comes out to about 85 targets, just three more than what he saw a season ago. The thing that's going to change the way that we view Kobe Fleener, though, is touchdowns. He scored just three touchdowns last year on 631 yards, which breaks down to a touchdown per 210 receiving yards. Tight ends last year scored touchdowns on every 146 yards. So there could be some positive regression in store for Fleener on top of the potential for him to see more targets without Cooks in the picture. As a dart throw, I'm totally fine with throwing a dart at Kobe Fleener. He'll probably drop it, but it's okay to throw one at him. This next one is from Maurice Moseri. Hi JJ, huge fan of the pod, and for the first time I have a fantasy football question that isn't ridiculously specific. I'm getting married this Monday, June 19th, and I want to hear your opinion on how to balance my marriage and my other hobbies, namely fantasy football, and of course my education in med school. Thanks. First off, Maurice, congratulations on getting hitched. People love to trash marriage because it's a popular guy thing to do, but marriage is a very, very great thing. Second, regarding your question, I think you need to quit med school. No, I'm just kidding. I don't feel like I'm going to give you a good answer to this because every relationship is different and unique, and it depends solely on how much time you're actually spending on things and so on. I just wanted to bring up this question on the podcast so that I could give you a congratulations before your big day. Enjoy every second of it. It's one of the best days of your entire life. This last one is from my buddy Sal at 2QBFFB. Can you please get the air horn artist on the pod and ask about his artistic process? So here's the thing. I went to Fiverr.com and got this dude to make the intro for the podcast. I wanted something dope AF, if you know what I mean, and that's what he did. He made a fire intro. But the air horn thing, if you want to talk about the artist, the air horn thing was me. I'm the air horn artist, guys. I actually added the air horns after getting the intro file from this dude who made it on Fiverr. I had the vision, and I went out and I tried to achieve the vision. What can I say? I am a true artist. That'll do it for the questions, though, guys. Thanks, as always, for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the show by searching for the Late Round Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. And as always, you can follow me on Twitter at LateRoundQB and the NumberFire Podcast Network at NumberFirePods. Have a good week, and I'll talk to you guys next week.